Köszöntöm ezeket, szervusztok! A következő nagyjából egy órában Paul Foxot, az Egyesült Királyság nagykövetét fogom majd kérdezni. Október közepétől új nagykövete lesz Magyarországon az Egyesült Királyságnak, a leköszönő nagykövet nagyjából 5 éven keresztül szolgálta hazáját országunkban. Számos kérdést fogunk majd érinteni, az ukrajnai háborút, a gázai konfliktust, egyáltalában azokat a kérdéseket, amelyek leginkább foglalkoztatják Európát és az Egyesült Királyságot. Szó lesz majd arról, hogy a mostani fegyverkezési verseny hogyan szolgálja az európai népek érdekét, egyáltalában össze lehet egyeztetni a biztonsági igényeket és közben a jóléti kiadásoknak a megőrzését. Ezen túlmenően pedig a magyar kormánnyal ápolt viszonyát, munkaviszonyát is fogjuk majd érinteni, és ezekkel kapcsolatban is fogom kérdezni a nagykövet urat. Ha még nem iratkoztál volna fel a csatornára, mindenképpen tedd meg, ha van bármilyen kérdésed vagy észrevételed az elhangzottakkal kapcsolatban, akkor várunk majd a komment szekcióban. Egyébként pedig, ha szeretnéd, hogy továbbra is ilyen tartalmakat állítsunk elő, akkor kérlek, hogy szállj be a finanszírozásunkba, a leírásban található lehetőségeken keresztül. Kezdünk! His Excellency Paul Fox, Ambassador of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland to Hungary. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and thank you for giving me the opportunity.
So in June, the embassy celebrated the birthday of King Charles III, and in your speech at this event, you criticized the radicalization of political discourse in Hungary. First of all, the demonization of minorities, second of all, the banning of pride, and third of all, the threats towards domestic critics of the government. You also said, and I'm quoting you, a line is being approached which you do not want to cross. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was commenting on what had been happening in Hungary in the previous 6 months. And, you know, I can understand the context because I think we've entered into an election period. And campaign has already started, even though the elections are some time away. And I wanted to express some disquiet about the nature of political discourse here in Hungary and how it become more shrill in recent times. And I was thinking about the banning of pride, the potential banning of pride, citing child protection, the proposed Transparency Act, which would seek to shut down organizations if they were deemed to be in some way foreign supported or foreign financed. And also I was thinking about the referendum or the national consultation on a potential membership of Ukraine in the EU. And some of the questions that accompanied the letter that went out to every household, which was basically, you know, saying if the Ukraine comes into the EU, you'll bring lots of criminals. If the Ukraine comes into the EU, their vaccination record is not as good as the EU. And it was.
You don't think that was based?
I don't know what the evidence for all of that is, but it just struck me as the tone of that was unhelpful. And I can understand it in terms of electioneering, and I can understand it in terms of trying to appeal to your core base. But, you know, you have to be, you know, I think we're living in very, very febrile times, and words matter. And you have to be very careful about the rhetoric you deploy.
Absolutely, words matter, but I'm interested about, so who was the imagined audience in your head? Did you send this message to the general public or directly to the government?
I was directing it to all Hungarians. I wasn't.
But all Hungarians are not responsible for such pamphlets, for example.
But I just wanted to raise awareness about it, and I also wanted to express a degree of disquiet, as I said. So I wasn't trying to intervene in the internal affairs. I wasn't advocating support for any particular party, group or individual.
But it was clearly the understanding of your speech of the government.
Well, I mean, the government of the day is taking these actions. But I mean, I made it perfectly clear in my speech that, you know, I wasn't telling Hungarians or the Hungarian government what to do. I was making it clear that your future is in your hands. Hmm. But, you know, in these very difficult times, in these very tense times, in these very febrile times, be careful about the language you deploy and the consequences of such language.
Many people assume that right after your speech, you will immediately get a call for a report to the foreign ministry. But we didn't hear about such a meeting to occur. So have you been questioned by the foreign ministry or anyone on behalf of the government?
Well, I had a friendly exchange with the defense minister, Krzysztof Solo-Bobrowiecki, where we discussed...
He congratulated you.
We discussed my speech. But no, nothing official, no condemnation, no expression of concern.
He congratulated to you after that speech?
Well, he didn't congratulate me. He just wanted to...
But he didn't share any criticism towards you?
No. He wasn't.
He was fine with your speech?
He wasn't critical of me, and he wasn't holding me to account. He just basically said, "I've heard about your speech. That's very interesting." And then we had a general discussion about what's happening in Hungary at the moment. But no, he hadn't been instructed to express any concern to me.
Okay. Despite your criticism towards to the government for banning Pride, your embassy didn't appear at this year's march.
Mm-hmm.
You yourself also avoided the event. Why did you do that?
Well, I think if you look at the event, it ended up being, I think, a great success. I mean, 100,000, 150,000, perhaps as many as 200,000 people.
Some estimation says it's more than 300,000.
You know, attended. And these were just ordinary Hungarians coming out to express support for the LGBT community. So, I mean, we look at it in that context. In terms of, you know, the role of embassies, I mean, we as a group of embassies discussed this. The government had written to each embassy to basically say your participation could be seen as being in contravention of, you know, various Vienna conventions.
Do you consider as a threat coming from the government?
No, I wouldn't want to put it as strongly as that. I mean, I think it was more...
It's more
of a question of we want to make you aware of how we will view such participation. But in the event, it was a big success and many ordinary Hungarians turned out and showed support for the, you know, LGBT plus community.
Other than that letter, did you receive any kind of or any form of a warning sign or even a threat?
No.
On behalf of the government or anybody related to the government?
No.
Because it was officially and legally a municipality event. So
yes. It
seems to me that your appearance would not fall under any kind of a criminality category. Mm-hmm. Don't you think it was a bad decision to avoid the event?
No, I don't think it was, because it ended up being a massive success. And, you know, hindsight's a marvellous thing, but... We looked at it in the run-up to the event. We spoke to other like-minded embassies about this. And I think, you know, we decided rather than have a formal presence, it would be better if we let the event run and make it clear that a large number of Hungarians were coming out in support of the community.
So certain types of tactical, I don't know, arguments were played in making that decision to not attend at the festival?
Well, we looked at it in the round, looked at it in terms of some of the, the letter we got from the Minister of Justice. We looked at it in terms of how would it impact upon the event. And, you know, our main concern is to ensure that the event was a success.
Let's jump to Russia, because your most recent service before Hungary was in Russia from 2018 to 2019. And in this period, the situation in Ukraine was far from ideal, and the Ukrainian war was already occurring. And let's say there were some positive tendencies so between Russia and Ukraine. For example, initially, Russia reacted positively to the election of Volodymyr Zelensky.
Mm-hmm.
And so-called ceasefire agreement also reached by the end of 2019 with prisoner swaps and military disengagement taking place after. In your estimation, a full-blown war was still avoidable back then?
Yes, I think it was still avoidable. I mean, it was a frozen conflict when I went there. I was there from 18 to 19. And, you know, we had the Minsk agreements in place, which basically froze the then front lines, as you call it.
Frozed or solved?
No, froze. I mean, it was a frozen conflict. It wasn't a resolved conflict, in my view.
That was your understanding of the agreement back at that time already?
I think the Minsk agreement, hindsight again, is a marvelous thing. I mean, the Minsk agreement failed. I mean, it clearly failed in 2022. But I think it showed how difficult it was to negotiate with Putin. It showed that he very rarely acted in good faith, and it showed that you have to judge him by his actions rather than his words. Mm. And also, it showed that...
Orban made similar comments.
Yeah, it showed that...
Before 2010.
Yeah, it showed that he will break his word if he feels it's in his interest to do so. I mean, you're right. I mean, we saw... You know, Putin gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2008 where, you know, he seemed to be showing a real shift in Russian foreign policy and also, you know, a real shift in Russia's attitudes towards its neighbourhood. Then we saw the short war in Georgia, and I was in Poland then, and my Polish friends were telling me, you know, this is typical Russian behaviour, and there's more of it to come. And then we saw in 2014, trying to move into Donetsk, Luhansk, and then they of course took over the whole of Crimea. And the Minsk agreement froze things, but it didn't resolve it. And it allowed Putin to go away, regroup, and try again. And I would say there were clear signs of him wanting to move again in 2021 when he wrote his essay about the history.
Yep.
Which, you know, isn't very good history, but is a clear declaration of intent. And it was clear by the end of 21, early 22, that, you know, he had designs on Ukraine, didn't really regard it as a real country, didn't respect its sovereignty, and felt it needed to come back into this Russian sphere of influence.
But there is a mainstream narrative, let's say criticism, not just shared by Fidesz or Viktor Orban, but also by non-partisan, respected analysts such as Mr. Marsheimer and others, that if Western powers had given greater security guarantees to Russia, for example, by denying Ukraine the opportunity to join or build a partnership with NATO, so then lasting ceasefire would have been achieved. What do you think about that?
I think the facts speak for themselves. I remember in February 2022, I was on a panel with the Russian ambassador here.
And, really?
Oh, yes, just before.
Who organised that panel?
It was just, I'm trying to remember, it was the previous Hungarian ambassador to the UK, Bobala Tsako.
Just to clear the timeline, that was on the very day of the start of the invasion?
It was about a week or so before the invasion. Okay. It was in February 22, and I'd been invited to a panel to discuss economic prospects in Hungary in 2022, and the Russian ambassador joined me. And he used that as an opportunity to basically accuse the West of provocation by expanding NATO. And of course, this was at the time when, you know, the Russians were making these points about we need a new European security architecture. And one of the things that should happen is NATO deployment should go back to the lines they held in 1997, i.e. before all the former Warsaw Pact countries joined NATO. And I just made, the point that, you know, NATO does not force itself upon people. Countries apply to join NATO. And the reason why countries want to be members of NATO in this region is that they do perceive a threat and they want to enjoy the collective security that NATO offers. It is not like the Warsaw Pact, an organisation that was forced upon countries. It's an organisation which countries apply to be members of. Because they want to enjoy the collective security it offers. And, you know, I think this argument that, you know, Putin had to invade the Ukraine because he felt threatened by the West is a red herring, as we say in English. I just think, you know, he didn't mention it in his essay in 21. It didn't really come up much. And, you know, I just think using it as a pretext to justify invading Ukraine, which I think, in my opinion, is basically an imperialist. It's an imperial mission. He wants to establish or re-establish a Russian sphere of influence, and he wants that sphere of influence to be recognized and accepted by the rest of the world. And I think he has a view of the world as being, you know, big power blocks, you know, with America, Russia, China, and that, you know, the international rules-based order just doesn't really matter anymore. Well, you know, we in the UK have a different point of view. We think the international rules-based order does matter, and it has, you know, maintained greater stability and peace since 1945 than anything which went before it.
Let's go into details, because my assumption is that the biggest conflict between your government and the Hungarian government is your understanding, or the difference of understanding, of the war in Ukraine. So, and you not shy away from any kind of a conflict, because you wrote an essay in Valas Online, which was published on their webpage. And in your article, you argued that Ukraine must prevail, that we, as the Euro-Atlantic community, should provide them all the support they need, financially and military-wise, and that we should increase the pressure on Russia even further. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean exactly by Ukraine must prevail?
Because it's more than just a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's not a Slavic civil war. It's not a conflict between people we know very little of and in a faraway country.
That's the official understanding of the Hungarian government.
Well, no, I'm talking about my view.
But you think they are wrong when they characterize this situation?
Well, I mean,
this conflict?
They often say this is not our war. They often say that people who support Ukraine are pro-war. They say Brussels is pro-war.
Yeah.
What I want to try and explain is the significance of this conflict. It's not just a conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Its outcome has profound implications for European security. And I think it's really important on a number of levels. First of all, aggression, unprovoked aggression, should not be seen to succeed. Putin should not be rewarded for it. You don't change borders by force. You don't undermine a neighbour's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And also, you know, if Putin is allowed to achieve his objectives, the question is, who's next? Where will he turn his sights on next? Particularly if he is intent on re-establishing a Russian sphere of influence. And so I think this conflict is the most important foreign policy issue, certainly in Europe, but one of the most important in the world. And I think it's important to ensure that the international rules-based order is maintained. I think it's really important to ensure that aggression is not rewarded, and it's really important to ensure that a country's sovereignty and territorial integrity is respected.
All due respect, sir, but what do you mean by guarantees of territorial integrity? Because it's obvious right now that Russia would only agree any kind of a peace agreement if their territorial needs or demands would be agreed by Ukraine. So they're not just asking for the territories currently held by their army, but also the entire Donetsk and Luhansk regions.
That's right.
And it seems to me that international allies are almost agreeing on that, yes, that's the price we should pay in order to achieve peace in Ukraine. What is your government's standpoint on this?
This war, I think it's a mistake to think that this war is just about territory.
Okay.
It's about Russia's desire to exert control, to re-establish influence, to re-establish an area which is seen as its area.
Yes.
So it's not just about territory. And when I say about territorial integrity, what I'm talking about is, as a general principle, you know, a country's sovereignty and its territorial integrity should be respected. But we are hopefully going to engage in the process. President Trump has been pushing for this. Let's hope that Putin engages with it in good faith. I have my doubts.
Viktor Orban thinks that the longer the war continues, the more territories Russia will occupy, and the worse peace deal Ukraine will get at the end of the entire conflict. So, and he's not alone with this opinion. Many politicians and military experts around Europe think the same. So do you think Ukraine can prevail on the long run against a country which is A, has a stronger economy, and B, has a much larger manpower pool?
I wonder about those assumptions. It seems to be based on received wisdom. Let's put it this way. Russia's rate of progress in the 3.5 years, if they maintained that rate of progress, they would occupy the whole of Ukraine after about 120 years. So it's not moving forward rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
Admittedly, they are making progress, but at extraordinary cost in both, you know, blood and treasure. I would also say that they don't have a limitless manpower pool. I think they are finding it increasingly difficult to recruit. They have to pay more and more money in order to get people to fight. And also, the economy is under increasing strain. It's now a war economy with, I think, 40% of, you know, government expenditure devoted to the military at the expense of healthcare, public, education, public services, so on and so forth. So, you know, this notion that they can indefinitely fight, I don't think it stands up to scrutiny. I'm not denying that, you know, Ukraine is under pressure, but that's where I think we need to support it to ensure that it is able to defend itself. I think one of the sad things about the conflict now, we are looking at a war of attrition, where you measure gains in metres rather than kilometres. And you're right as well. I mean, we all want a peace settlement. The UK has wanted a peace settlement ever since the war broke out. But it's got to be a just, enduring and sustainable peace settlement, which is why we're talking about coalitions of the willing, which is why we are welcoming President Trump's offer of security guarantees. You know, so what we don't want is a situation where Putin is allowed to regroup and return.
That's understandable, but what's your government's official standpoint on this issue? So does your government believe that any kind of a long-lasting peace agreement can be achieved without A, accepting the territorial demands of Russia,
mm-hmm.
B, denying the join of Ukraine to NATO?
I think what we have to do is engage in the process, which we haven't done yet.
What's your proposal?
As I've said, you know, the UK government's view towards Ukraine is that we think it has a European perspective, and we think we believe in its Euro-Atlantic integration, and that may include membership of NATO. But, you know, that is something which would need to be discussed within NATO. And it's a process as well. But, you know, we have made it clear, and I'll just reiterate it and repeat it, we don't want this war just to go on forever. We're not sort of supporting Ukraine because we are pro-war or suffer from psychosis.
But then compromise is sure the cure.
But, I mean, we want a peace process which will produce a, you know, a durable,
what's the price? What's the price?
We'll have to see as what comes out of the negotiations. But
okay, but territorial demands are on the table or not?
But a key player at the table has to be Ukraine. It can't be an agreement which exempts, which exempts Ukraine. And when it comes to territory, that is something which Ukraine has to have a determining voice on.
So territorial demands are on the table.
Well, the Russians are putting them on the table, aren't they? But there's got to be a process. And the Ukraine has to be at the table, and the Ukraine has to be a determining voice to what happens.
Okay. Let's talk about the coalition of the willing, because you already mentioned that in your previous answer. And it was formed right after the, let's say, first infamous meeting between President Zelensky and President Donald Trump. And Hungary was not invited to join. And Prime Minister Orbán already accused the coalition of having no plan other than arming Ukraine until it achieves full victory, which in his opinion is impossible. How do you respond on this?
I don't quite agree with that characterization. Prime Minister Starmer, President Macron came together, I think, with several objectives in mind. One, to signal to Washington that Europe is prepared to play a key role and that we're not just expecting the US to do all the heavy lifting. So I think that's the first thing. And secondly, to explore what realistically can be achieved in any post-settlement situation where we can help ensure a durable and sustainable peace. Now, discussions continue about the details of it, and we are discussing it with the Americans as well. But, you know, I don't think the characterization was this is a coalition which was, you know, basically just going to keep on stoking the war endlessly. That's not the intention. The intention is to show that the Europeans are stepping up, and also some non-Europeans in the coalition, the winning, in order to ensure that any post-settlement in the situation in Ukraine is upheld and a sustainable peace is reinforced.
And what is going on within the coalition of the willing nowadays? So during the previous meeting in the White House, the name was not mentioned, not even by NATO members, not even by other European leaders. And so what is going on behind the curtain?
There were still consultations, you know. Us, along with our French friends, are continuing to talk. I mean, it's very hard to have detailed planning for a situation which is to be applied following the settlement until there is a settlement. But it's about being prepared. But of course, this all depends upon Putin acting in good faith, and there's no evidence that he's prepared to do that at the moment.
Also, what does it mean to send a reassurance force to Ukraine after the end of the war? In my understanding, this is also a kind of a catch-22 situation.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing Ukraine wants in order to achieve any kind of a peace agreement, which is very similar to a NATO 5 article guarantee. But of course, it's clearly against the will of Russia and the demands of Russia. So what kind of a reassurance force could be deployed on Ukrainian territory?
Nothing has been determined. And I wouldn't want to give the impression that this has all been planned out to the final detail. There's still a lot to be discussed. And it very much depends upon what the facts on the ground are. There's an offer on the table. There are a range of options being considered. I mean, one of the things which the US administration mentioned following Alaska and Washington was, as I said, I think it was Steve Witkoff, some type of Article 5 security guarantee to Ukraine. Well, a lot, the devil's going to be in the detail.
But
the point, and I don't want to give the impression that it's all been sorted out, because it hasn't. But I think the intention is to demonstrate that Europe, a range of countries and the states are willing to provide security guarantees to Ukraine to ensure that Putin just doesn't regroup, rearm and return.
There is a new wave of rearmament spending among or across Europe, and UK has committed to increase its defence spending to 5% of its GDP by 2035.
Yes.
And many Europeans share the fear that the growing military spending all over the continent combined with a less than, let's say, ideal economic situation means that the military funding will be paid with welfare cuts or other kind of cut of social spendings or on healthcare, education and so on. So, which will lead to a decline of the quality of life and the rise of radical parties, radical political forces. So is rearmament really in Europe's interest, even if the price is so high?
I can understand those concerns. You know, we live in tough times economically. But I would say, given the challenge we face, it's justified. I think we do have to increase our defence spending because the challenge we face is such that without it, we leave ourselves open and vulnerable. We do have a resurgent Russia whose ambitions, I think, extend beyond Ukraine. And we need to be able to confront that convincingly. So, hence the agreement at the recent NATO summit in The Hague to collectively increase our defence spending. You're right, it will probably mean some sacrifices.
But there's another threat of social exclusion, mm-hmm. which could lead to much worse situation, not just in the UK, but in any other given European country. So do you think that the social price we have to pay in order to have, I don't know, better army equipment mm-hmm. or a more stronger military is a desirable future for Europe?
I think we have to be prepared to deal with the challenges we face. And it's not just, it's not just about conventional armed forces. It's about the range of tools deployed against the West, whether it be, hybrid warfare, cyber warfare, disinformation, interference in the internal affairs of the countries of the EU and the West, attempts to influence the electorate and all of that. I think if you look at what the defence spending is involved, 3.5% is going to be devoted to developing conventional forces. 1.5% is going to be used to developing the ability to counter those broader range of hybrid warfare against us. And I think it is justified. Otherwise, if we don't stand up to it, we leave ourselves very much open.
But if there will be less sources for spending on social inclusion, how can European countries, European states fight against extremism, against all of the bad tendencies within their societies?
Well, in terms of the rise of populism and so on and so forth, the roots of that are deep and they go back a long way. All I would say is that the alternative of doing nothing wouldn't really deal or dampen those radical populist forces. In fact, it could make them worse.
Hmm. Also, there is already an ongoing tension in your country because the British government certainly tried to pass a bill promoting large welfare cuts recently. And although they could only pass a watered-down version of the bill, but we see that meanwhile the right-wing populist reform party is stronger than ever.
Yes.
And comfortably leading the polls.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't this a sign of we are going on the bad road and we should take some amendments into consideration in order to prevent the radicalization of our societies in Europe?
Yeah. I think we've got to be careful because there's a particular political context what's happening.
Yeah, but you're going to leave your office within 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's true. But I think there is what's going on in the UK. I'm not saying it's unique to the UK, but it has a very strong British flavour. Mm. And what we're seeing, now I've got to be careful because I'm not here to commentate on British politics, but what we are seeing is the two-party system under pressure where you've had Conservative and Labour for a very long time. If you look at the polls, there's four or five parties who are on 20 plus percent. Reform's on 28, Labour's on 20, the Conservatives on 17, the Lib Dems are on 16, the Greens are on 11.
Mm.
And so the old duopoly between between Labour and the Conservatives are under pressure. Now, whether this is a permanent realignment or a temporary one, I don't know. But something has happened, I would say, and this has been developing probably since 2016, since the referendum on the EU. I think what Reform have done is they've offered something which is tapping into some of the concerns that have emerged over the last decade within the UK. So I think you've got to see it within the terms of a realignment. So I wouldn't link that to what's happening in Ukraine and Russia. I wouldn't link that necessarily to the decision taken to increase defence spending. I think there is a rather unique British aspect to all of this.
Another aspect, which is worrisome, that Europe is already behind when it comes to investing in technology, AI and other developments behind the US, behind China. And instead of investing into new technologies and new territories, we are spending on rearmament. So how can we deal with that kind of trouble that we are far behind of investing into these very important technologies of the 21st century?
No, you're right. I mean, in terms of, well, there's an issue within the EU, but it applies in the UK as well, but about the need to be increasingly competitive and about the need to invest more in new technologies, and AI is the big buzz term of the moment. But, you know, it's symptomatic of the fact that we're living in a world where technology is developing extremely quickly. And you need to be abreast of it. I mean, you know, I think we in the UK are in quite a good position when it comes to, say, you know, technological development. One aspect of this being in the nuclear energy field, where Rolls-Royce are developing small modular reactors. And we're talking to the Hungarian government about that as well. But, you know, I don't see it so binary in that respect. You know, you either invest in new technology or you invest in military. I mean, if you've, you know, investing in the military can also spur on technological development. But at the same time, you're correct in sort of saying we only have a certain size cake and we've got to divide it in such a way, and there are so many demands upon it. You have to take decisions about what to invest it in. But the UK government is very much focused on the growth agenda, is very much focused on promoting prosperity, because they feel that the best way of dealing with this conundrum is by increasing the size of the cake, and you just do that through growth.
I would like to touch another aspect of your speech back in June, because you implied that the so-called transparency law was a clear step towards censorship by the Orban government, and that's a very mainstream narrative, so many critics are saying similar criticism towards the Orban government. But how do you respond to the criticism that you and your government are being hypocritical in condemning such actions, given that the UK proscribing the civil disobedience group Palestine Action as a terrorist organization?
Yes.
A move that was widely condemned as a serious overreaction by numerous human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International and other NGOs, and even by the United Nations.
But Palestine Action, you know, caused criminal damage on military equipment, millions of pounds worth of damage, and it was following that way they were prescribed.
But there are no record cases of murders or serious bodily harm committed by the Palestine Action.
But, you know, I would still say that was a challenge to UK's national security. We're not saying people can't protest. We're not saying that people can't express their concerns about what's happening in Gaza. People do every week and in larger numbers on the streets of London. Peaceful protest is something enshrined, it's in our DNA. It's very much part and parcel of our values. So peaceful legal protest is not being undermined or banned or prescribed. Anything which is illegal and violent, that's what's being focused on. So people can still express their concerns about what's going on in Gaza, express their opposition to what Israel is doing there, but it's got to be done in a peaceful and legal way.
So do you categorically deny that this is a proof of double standard?
No, I do categorically. I don't think it is a proof of double standards. I mean, we are not trying to place constraints on freedom of assembly. We're not trying to place constraints on freedom of speech. We are just focused on an organisation which, indulges in criminal and illegal behaviour.
Although the UK did sanction some Israeli officials.
That's right.
And limited military exports to Israel, these sanctions came months after the atrocities erupted in Gaza. and they are not nearly as harsh as the sanctions against Russia. Mm-hmm. Britain also conducted several hundred spy flights over Gaza, supporting the Israeli operations. Mm-hmm. And British companies are still selling, with, okay, some restrictions, but still selling military equipment to Israel. So your critics can easily say that your government is not really committed to the rule-based international order, but rather to the interests of Western powers and its allies. What is your response to that?
We're not exercising double standards. We just have one standard, and that's international law, observance of international law. And the Foreign Secretary has said on numerous occasions in Parliament and elsewhere that Israeli actions in Gaza, some Israeli actions in Gaza, risk contravening international humanitarian law. Obviously, this has got to be established in a court of law. But we have expressed our misgivings. We've expressed our alarm at some of the statements made by members of the Israeli government, particularly about settlements in the West Bank, but also in terms of some of the statements about what should happen to the Palestinian population in Gaza.
Would your government call what's going on in Gaza as a genocide?
That's got to be determined by a competent international body.
But this is a discussion going on within the government?
We're always keeping an eye on whether there have been contraventions of international humanitarian law. I mean, what do we want in Gaza? First of all, we want an immediate ceasefire. We want all the hostages released by Hamas. We want aid to flow in, and we will step up and provide the,
Then why don't you put more pressure on Israel?
Well, I think sanctioning two members of the cabinet is, pretty significant pressure.
Those sanctions as not nearly as harsh mm-hmm. as the sanctions against Russia.
But they are sanctions all the same. And we are making it clear to the Israeli government about what we think is the right thing to do. And I've just explained what I think. What we think is the right thing to do, and we will continue to make that make that clear.
I think your government's position on the Srebrenica massacre is that you label it as a genocide, mm-hmm. right?
I think that was determined in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia that it was a genocide.
And you accept that?
Well, because it was from a competent and a credible international organization, a court.
Because according to the Israeli military's own data, 83% of Palestinians killed by the IDF were civilians. Mm. This is a figure not far behind of the figure occurred in Srebrenica.
Yeah. What's happening in Gaza is a humanitarian catastrophe. There's no two ways about it. And
labeling it as a humanitarian catastrophe is not watering down.
And, we have expressed our misgivings about the latest operation which the IDF have embarked upon because ultimately you've got to have a settlement there as well. We've made it clear that Hamas has no role in Gaza's future, but to continue a military operation in that area, which is just making things worse, is not taking us anywhere nearer to any sort of solution or peaceful settlement.
Okay, as far as I understand, so whether it's the genocide or not, it's under discussion or under investigation by your government. But does your government accept that the famine, which is occurring in Gaza, was caused intentionally by Israel?
No, I'm not sure about the intentionality of it, but one of the things we do say is that aid has got to be allowed to flow.
And who's preventing that to flow into the area? Yeah, but who's responsible for preventing the aid coming to Gaza, other than Israel?
Yeah, you have to speak to Israelis about that, but I think they would say they were doing it as part of a military operation. But the point is, we believe that aid should be allowed to flow in much greater quantities than it is at the moment, okay, in order to deal with, the humanitarian catastrophe that's occurring there.
Arriving in the last phase of our interview, I would like to ask you about the economic relations between Hungary and the UK. Although there are disagreements on foreign policies and certain domestic issues between UK and Hungary, economic relations between the two countries are thriving. Mm-hmm. We can say that. The United Kingdom is Hungary's fourth largest trading partner in terms of both imports and exports. The UK heavily invests in Hungary. More than 50,000 Hungarians are employed by British companies. Mm-hmm. So Prime Minister Orbán's economic policy was criticized as unpredictable by many international organizations. For example, the German-Hungarian Chamber of Commerce. Mm. Do you view the Hungarian government as a reliable partner for British investors or not?
Before I go into that specific answer, I mean, just in terms of the general picture, I mean, the British commercial footprint here is quite significant, as you've pointed out.
And growing.
I mean, like the value of bilateral trade is over £8 billion now, and it's increased by 50% in the last 4 years. So, that's working. The value of UK investment here is about £3 billion. Lots of big companies here: Tesco, BP, Diageo, Unilever, Ernst & Young. We have a big presence here. One thing I would say is British investors have received a lot of help from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and in particular from HIPAA, headed up by István Yu. And they have worked hard to create a favourable environment for investment. And Mr. Seato has been very helpful. I mean, in terms of Unilever expanding its footprint, he's played a role. When it comes to relations there, I think things are in good shape. So I think Hungary is seen as having great potential. Of course, Hungary is going through some economic difficulties at the moment. But I think British investors will see the potential and will probably say, just as German investors have with the auto trade, and American investors have, and so on and so forth.
But do you share those concerns raised by these organizations?
About what in particular?
The reliability of the government, the trustworthiness of the government.
I wouldn't say share the concerns, but we keep a very close eye on the business environment. And there are times when I do discuss with a range of Hungarian organizations market access issues, just to ensure that British companies are able to make the most of being here.
Yes, but let's pick a case like, for example, Tesco, a very important company in the UK, both in Hungary.
Yeah.
And for many years, the Hungarian government has been taking actions to squeeze foreign supermarket chains out of Hungary to bring these cheese chains under, let's say, local and loyal ownership. So, for example, if the CEO of Tesco would ask you whether their investments are in a safe position in Hungary, what would be your response to him or her?
I would say at the moment, their investment is safe. And the way in which a company like Tesco is able to prove its value is by the service it offers. And by, I think it offers something which very few companies can. Its supply chains are second to none. It has a network of stores across Hungary, and it gives the customers what they want. So that's what I would point to. In order to prove your worth, you provide the customer with what they want.
But are you aware of any attempts by the government in any sectors to either displace or purchase or otherwise influence any British companies?
Not overtly. I think, and I haven't received any complaints from British companies to that effect. And that's what I can say. But, you're right. There has been a drive within Hungary to promote national champions. There has been a drive to try and identify sectors which should be dominated by Hungarian players, the banking sector, the construction sector, and so on. But, of course, this is where the EU comes into play because, as you probably know, some of the big retailers have expressed concerns about some of the taxes that have been imposed upon them, and they've gone to Brussels to engage in the due process, and with Hungary being a member of the EU, I mean, they have to take part in that process. So there is recourse if there are concerns.
Many fellow ambassadors of yours come and go during your tenure in Hungary. So you have a very rich experience in working together with the government. So how would you characterize your professional relationship with the government by your experience?
Very professional. I have a very professional relationship with the government here.
That can mean a lot. I mean, friendly, open.
I'd say it's certainly open. And we certainly...
You didn't pick friendly.
No, I mean, well, sometimes we disagree on issues. Like, for argument's sake, we disagree on what's happening with the war. I wouldn't say it was unfriendly. I think we agree to disagree. One of the things I do enjoy about being here is that you can engage in, you know, a very good dialogue without necessarily damaging the friendship. And I mean, my 5 years here, I've had a huge range of very interesting conversations, and that's the thing I do enjoy about here. In contrast, when I was in Moscow, you can actually engage and have a true exchange of ideas, opinions, views, etc.
Yeah, but Russia is an open dictatorship. So how would you how would you characterize then the political situation in Hungary?
It's still a democracy. It is still a democracy, without a shadow of a doubt.
A democracy with some problems, or I don't know.
All democracies have problems.
Okay.
Hungary has its fair share of them.
And my very last question. Have you ever met with Mr. Orban?
Yes. Yes. Mainly with Boris Johnson, when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister. I've met him a couple of times at football matches. And also, I remember when there was an event in the Castle District at St. Matthias, the St. Matthias Cathedral, where they were doing a premiere, or rather, not a premiere, they were performing Liszt's Coronation Mass, first time being performed here since the coronation of Franz Joseph back in the 1860s. And I was with my late wife, and she knew Prime Minister Orban's wife, Annika, and she came up and she got my wife and said, "You must come and meet my husband." So I came along, and Mr. Orban saw my wife, and my wife introduced herself saying, "I'm Vicky Fox, I am the British ambassador's wife." And he introduced himself by saying, "I'm Viktor Orban, I'm the Hungarian Prime Minister for now." And it was extraordinarily charming. And he just focused on her.
That's his fame, yeah.
So that was the most relaxed I'd seen him, but I've also seen him in meetings with, you know, the Prime Minister.
Of course, and you had a lot of meetings with Peter Szijjártó as well.
Yeah, quite a few meetings.
You think that's feasible, that he can replace one day Viktor Orban when he will be not the Prime Minister of Hungary anymore?
Do you think
he has the political capacity, the political charisma to fulfill such a role?
I'm in a place to comment on that, to be perfectly honest.
Is that feasible or not? I'm not saying that you are willing or desiring for such a situation for Mr. Szijjártó. I'm just saying that, do you think that he has?
Mr. Szijjártó, along with a number of other Hungarian politicians, has been on the front line of politics for some time. And so, as and when Mr. Orban steps down, he could well be in the mix along with others.
His Excellency Paul Fox, thank you very much for your time and for the chance to sit down with us for this interview. Also, please write your memoir, because I know that this is your last position as a diplomat, so you are going to finish your career with Hungary. So thank you very much for your service, really.
Thank you.
And please write that memoir and come back to the show and let's talk about your other experiences, because I think that would be absolutely interesting for our audience. So I would love to continue another sit down and another interview with you.
I'll be happy to do so. I mean, I intend to come back to Hungary.
when you have, I don't know, less diplomatic restrictions?
Oh, yes.
And more space for free speech?
I'm a strong believer in free speech, as is the UK.